And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning is Dan McNulty, assistant professor of the Department of Wildland Resources from Utah State University. And he's just written a book, Wolves on the Hunt, The Behavior of Wolves Hunting Wild Prey. Because of wolves' habitat, their speed, and general success at evading humans, researchers have faced great obstacles studying their natural hunting behaviors. This is the first book to focus explicitly on wolf hunting of wild prey. Professor McNulty, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, great to have you here. You know, anyone that camps out in a teepee in Yellowstone in the middle of the winter to observe wolves hunting bison, you must love wolves. So take a moment and tell us about your fascination with wolves and why you wrote this book.
Well, I guess my interest in wolves really has to do with my interest in wildland ecosystems, really. You know, systems, natural environments that are fairly free of presence of humans, and just my interest in being able to watch natural processes occur without interference from people. And wolves and bison in Yellowstone is a good example of that. There are very few places in the world, really, that you can observe wolves hunting bison, which is a little ironic because not so long ago, wolves and bison dominated most of North America. You know, the whole Central Plains up into Canada, lots of wolves, lots of bison. And so wolf-bison interactions were a real common sight. And that's apparent in a lot of the journals from naturalists and frontiersmen that came out into the plains in the early 1800s. And yet, that system was essentially eliminated, and so we only have pockets remaining, one of which is in Yellowstone. And so really what I've just been really fascinated by is just observing this historical interaction between wolves and bison, but also between wolves and other prey, in particular in Yellowstone with elk. And elk are actually their primary prey in Yellowstone, and that's most of what we see them hunt. Although we have seen them hunt other species, bighorn sheep, pronghorn deer, but those are by far more rare than our observations of wolves hunting elk. And in terms of the motivation for the book, really what we wanted to do was to bring together in one volume actual firsthand accounts by biologists of wolves hunting a variety of wild prey in the temperate zone. So bison, elk, bighorn sheep, but also caribou, muskox, doll sheep, species that we don't find here necessarily in the lower 48 United States. And the reason why that's significant is because we have a lot of misunderstanding of how wolves hunt wild prey among members of the public. People just assume that wolves can go out and kill just about anything they want, and that's not true at all. And our goal was to provide really kind of a blow-by-blow. This is what happens when wolves hunt. This is what we're seeing when wolves hunt. So sort of an unadulterated account of how wolves hunt, just to give the public a firsthand view of how this process happens, the details. And those accounts also are accompanied by video footage by Bob Landis, who's an award-winning cinematographer based up in Yellowstone. Many of the accounts have with them video footage that shows the actual interaction between wolves and the particular prey as filmed by Bob. So a lot of it relates to wolf-elk interactions as well as wolf-bison interactions.
Right. Well, Professor McNulty, if you look at, you know, deer and doll sheep and mountain goats and rabbits and beavers, I mean, those are a certain size, but bison, those are huge. I was surprised right. to hear that they go after an animal that big.
Bison represent, based on the data that is available, bison represent the most difficult prey for wolves in North America. And it's not only because bison are big, but also because bison are social. They work together to defend themselves. Elk, deer, they don't do that to the degree that bison do. And so trying to bring down a bison is a bit like trying to break into Fort Knox. You've got to get through the robust defenses that bison maintain, and bison just don't stand there. They actively defend themselves. They're kicking, they're charging, they're using their horns to hook and throw wolves. We've had wolves killed by bison, and as a result, bison are really a prey of last resort for wolves. They would prefer to hunt easier prey that are safer to kill. And a lot of accounts of wolves feeding on bison actually involve wolves scavenging on bison that died for other reasons. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the accounts actually from the early 1800s of wolves and bison on the Great Plains actually involves wolves scavenging. A lot of wolves would feed on bison that had drowned as they were crossing major rivers, like the Missouri River, for example. Lots of, like Lewis and Clark, I believe, described those accounts on the Great Falls of the Missouri of wolves, basically bobbing up and down in the water trying to get at bison carcasses that were floating downstream. So that pattern is consistent with what we see today in Yellowstone. So, yes, bison occasionally are prey for wolves, but most of the bison that we see wolves feeding on are bison that have died for other reasons, primarily exposure to winter conditions, injury for other reasons, that kind of thing.
Professor McNulty, before we continue into how wolves hunt their prey, I want to kind of go back and set the stage. I know you were involved in the Yellowstone Wolf Project since its inception in 1995. And, some would say about the reintroduction of the wolves into Yellowstone, that was very successful. Some would say too successful. Can you just quickly, talk about what was the demise? What was the downturn of the wolf population that led to the reintroduction? And did it have something to do with how it hunts? And in this case, not successfully.
No, I mean, wolves vanished from Yellowstone due to the activities of humans. So they were hunted and trapped out of Yellowstone National Park in the early 20th century. The U.S. military, when they were managing Yellowstone, they were involved in removing wolves as well. And then park managers following that were also involved in killing off wolves. Because you have to remember, in the early 20th century, really up until the 1950s, predators, and even after the 1950s, but it started to change in the 50s, the perception of predators as being, ecological villains, really. And that view is still, persists today, but not to the extent that it did in the early 20th century, when wolves were widely regarded by wildlife scientists, wildlife managers, as pests to be removed from natural landscape.
Why? Let me ask you.
That's what led to the removal.
I just want to ask you a question about why the notion and why so many people, like you say, lay people, believe this still, that wolves are ecological villains, that they kill for sport, not for food. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, I mean, a lot of it starts with some of the ancient myths from Europe and, Little Red Riding Hood. Wolves have been portrayed as villains going back, millennia, right? And even to this day, there was a film recently, The Gray, I believe it was called, that portrayed wolves as man-eaters and really as having these sort of supernatural powers of predation ability, I suppose. And wolves are just sort of a convenient scapegoat, really, for all kinds of anxieties that people have. And so we project onto wolves, oftentimes, the ability to do all these these bad things, but also there's flip side to that. We also oftentimes project onto them their ability to do all these things in terms of, so there's a view of wolves as sort of being ecological superheroes too, that they can transform ecosystems overnight by scaring their prey, by killing off all the coyote, for example, in Yellowstone. So there are sort of mythologies on both sides in terms of the people who view wolves as a good thing and people who view wolves as a bad thing.
Right.
And the truth is really right down the middle.
Right. So things like fairy tales and Hollywood aside, talk about the practices of wolves when they're hunting that have led to some of those beliefs, like, I don't know, going into a field full of grazing sheep or something and killing off a couple and then taking off. Is that something that really happens or not?
Well, so if you're referring to domestic sheep, yes. And it's not just wolves that kill a lot of sheep in a single attempt, but other predators, grizzly bears, coyotes, will do the same. And the reason why is because domestic sheep have very few, if any, natural defenses against predators. They're small. They're not especially smart. You know, the wild sheep, their natural anti-predator behavior would be to flee to escape terrain. As a last resort, they'll use their horns. They'll kick, that kind of thing. But their natural anti-predator behavior is to flee to escape terrain, to avoid predators. And domestic sheep on a pasture, you know, they don't have that option, even if they, you know, were able to do that, if they still had that behavior. But the key thing about wolf-prey interactions in terms of how wolves hunt, wolves are looking for an opportunity to take down a prey that is a safe opportunity. And the reason why is because these prey, not just bison, but also elk and white-tailed deer and the smaller prey even, they can be quite dangerous. And wolves often are injured and killed in the process. And the reason why we have a outsized view, I suppose, of the ability of wolves to kill prey is, you know, not only the exaggeration in Hollywood, but also the fact that the way in which wolves kill prey can at times be gruesome. And the reason why is because they don't have a lot of effective killing equipment, like, say, a mountain lion or an African lion would have. In other words, they don't have these retractable claws. They don't have elbows that rotate so they can grab a hold of the prey. Mm-hmm. All they can do is simply grab the prey with their teeth, primarily their canines and their incisors. That is the extent of their killing equipment. And as a result, the way in which they kill big prey, like bison, for example, there's no killing bite that they put on an adult bison.
They wear them down.
They wear them down. They bite them until they go into shock and they die. And quite honestly, it's not the prettiest picture, but that's the strategy that wolves have evolved and have been using for thousands of years. It works for them because, see, wolves are a generalist predator. That's the success of wolves. That's why they're distributed across the northern hemisphere, because they can eat a wide range of prey. And so they have a very sort of generalized skull morphology that allows them to take on a lot of different prey. But it also means that, you know, they're not able to make killing bites. They're not able to swiftly kill their prey necessarily. Now, sometimes they can, like if they're killing an adult female elk, for example, the way that they kill that animal, they'll grab the trachea and they'll basically suffocate the animal, and that actually occurs pretty rapidly. But if they're dealing with a big prey like a bull elk or bull bison, it's not quite that way. And we can't blame wolves for how they evolve. That is just the body plan that they have, and that's how they use that body plan to kill prey.
Right. And you mentioned earlier the movie The Gray with Liam Neeson. I saw that movie.
Yeah.
And I was rooting for the wolves.
Well, that movie was absolutely ridiculous And
I just don't like Liam Neeson. It had nothing to do with him. I was just rooting for the Wolves. You know, Liam Neeson, you know, he's shooting everything. He's on airplanes shooting people. He's flying around the globe shooting people, blowing stuff up. And I'm thinking, I don't know if this is accurate with the Wolves or not, but, man, I hope these guys get him.
Well, and so really our book is really an attempt as an antidote to that kind of misinformation.
Right.
And, you know, honestly, I'm pessimistic. I'm sure in another few years there's going to be another film like that. Because like I said, Wolves are such a convenient scapegoat. They're such a convenient boogeyman to use in Hollywood or in other forms of media. But with our book, though, we're hoping to get the facts out there about how wolves actually do make a living in terms of being a predator in a natural environment.
Right. Professor McNulty, what I'm fascinated about is that, yeah, we know that wolves are killers, but you say in the book that many lay people believe that wolves kill for the sheer sport of it. Is that true?
No, it's absurd. Of course not.
Yeah.
Wolves make a living by killing large prey, just like other large carnivores do, okay? It's not just wolves that do this. Cougars, grizzly bears, they oftentimes are predators of ungulates. Black bears, even, are predators of young ungulates that are just recently born. So carnivores eat other animals to make a living, and humans fall into that category. We are also killers of large ungulates as well. And, you know, that's another potential reason why wolves are often scapegoated, is because there's perceived to be competition between hunters, human hunters, and wolves for ungulates, for hoofed animals. They don't kill for sport. They kill to feed their offspring and to feed themselves in order for them to reproduce the following year. So there's nothing to do with sport here. That's just an absurd notion.
So and back to kind of what I was asking you before about how they go into a field of domesticated sheep or whatever it is and kill. And I think that's where I have heard that they kill for sport, that they will kill and then they will leave their prey and not even eat it. So that part you're saying does not happen, or does it sometimes happen with domesticated animals but not animals in the wild? I'm still unclear on that.
If they have an opportunity to make multiple kills, they will. But they don't just leave them there. They will, given the opportunity, come back and feed on those carcasses. And they will sometimes cache that food up in the Arctic, for example, where food is scarce. They'll make multiple kills if possible, and they'll stash portions of that carcass and revisit those sites. So wolves live often a feast and famine existence, and so when an opportunity presents itself to make multiple kills, they will do so, but it's not for sport. It's for food.
Okay.
They will eat that prey. And so, yes, multiple kills happen, but it's part of their life history. It's part of the way in which they make a living in a natural environment.
Our guest is Professor Dan McNulty of Utah State University. He's co-written a book called Wolves on the Hunt, The Behavior of Wolves Hunting Wild Prey. I want to mention your co-writers, David Meck and Douglas Smith. Now, I believe they're from Minnesota or Nebraska. They're also...
So David Meech, he's a biologist at the University of Minnesota in the United States Geological Survey. He's based at the University of Minnesota. And Douglas Smith is the Wolf Project leader in Yellowstone National Park, and he's based there in Mammoth Hot Springs.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, you know, we talked about the villainization of wolves on the one hand, and then you said on the other hand, and I've seen cuts from a film recently out that talks about the regeneration of entire ecosystems in Yellowstone due to the presence of wolves. And so you say that's also kind of out on the other extreme and the truth lies in the middle. So talk about that argument about how the presence of wolves have regenerated ecosystems?
Well, it's in Yellowstone, it's an unfolding story. In other words, wolves have only been there for about 20 years now since the reintroduction, and there has been a response in some places in terms of the vegetation, so aspen and willow and to some extent cottonwood in some places have regenerated.
Because there's not so much grazing, is that why?
Yes, that's the hypothesis. There's fewer elk, and as a result, there's less browsing pressure on those woody plants, and that then allows those plants to grow to heights that they weren't able to grow in the past. And there are, without a doubt, pretty impressive places where there has been regeneration of aspen. And just in my 20 years being there, I was very surprised, or impressed, I should say, in seeing some of these areas. The Crystal Creek area, for example, and the Northern Range of Yellowstone comes to mind. But then there are also other aspen stands that have shown very little regeneration or response.
Okay.
So the effect is not evenly distributed across the Northern Range. And it's difficult to completely attribute that effect, that regeneration response, to wolves. There has been a decline in the elk population, but that decline isn't necessarily wholly attributable to wolves. There are other factors that are involved. We've had, when wolves were reintroduced, that after the second reintroduction in 1996, shortly after that, major multi-year drought set in, and that influences elk population dynamics through its effect on the summer range. Summer range conditions influence elk reproduction, and that has effect on elk numbers. In addition to that, you have other predators, grizzly bears, cougars, and then also in the early years of the reintroduction, elk that left the park continued to be hunted during what was called the late winter hunt, and that focused primarily on antlerless elk, which were typically adult female elk that were of prime breeding age. So that also had a role in the decline. So a lot of factors at play during the past 20 years, and it's a convenient story, and it makes for sort of interesting headlines that, yes, wolves are, you know, responsible for these ecological changes, but there's a lot of other things that have been happening in that system in Yellowstone.
Okay.
So as scientists, what we're trying to do is tease apart the relative contributions of these different factors in causing these changes, causing the change in numbers, as well as causing changes in the distribution and regeneration of these different woody plants.
Professor McNulty, just have one final question. We just have about 30 seconds left, but you mentioned before about competing interests, and those would be hunters. They seem to be incredibly villainized. I mean, they're on a wolf hunt. You know, hunters hate wolves. Why is that?
Well, no, I wouldn't say all hunters hate wolves. I have a lot of friends that are hunters who really enjoy wolves. So I think that that's not an accurate characterization. There's a lot of diversity in views about wolves, whether you're a hunter or not.
Okay.
And I think maybe a lot of the vocal opposition to wolves that get headlines, oftentimes those voices come from the hunting community, but I would not paint the hunting community overall as anti-wolf.
Dan, we want to thank you for joining us this morning. And
oh, you're welcome.
Your
Thanks
book.
For inviting me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so Dan McNulty, Assistant Professor of the Department of Wildland Resources, Utah State University, and the author of Wolves on the Hunt, The Behavior of Wolves Hunting Wild Prey. We shall return right after these messages.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City News. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
The Park City Chamber Bureau will host its annual summer kickoff mixer on Thursday, June 11th from 4 to 7 p.m. at PCMR's Legacy Lodge. It showcases Chamber Bureau members who provide summer activities, entertainments, and events for Park City. There will be plenty of free food, prize drawings, lots of swag, and a cash bar. The event is free and open to the public. More information? Contact a nonprofit Chamber Bureau, a proud supporter of KPCW, at 649-6100.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We are just speaking with Professor Dan McNulty, Assistant Professor in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University and the author of the book Wolves on the Hunt, The Behavior of Wolves Hunting Wild Prey. Our next guest is Brandon Brown. He's the author of the book Planck, Driven by Vision, Broken by War. Max Planck is credited with being the father of quantum theory, and his work was described by his close friend Albert Einstein as the basis of all 20th century physics. His work was accomplished while living in war-torn Germany. During the war, his son was accused of treason while Germany was crumbling. The book also takes us through these extraordinary challenges, as well as the story of Planck's friendship with the far more outspoken Albert Einstein. Biographer Brandon Brown, now joining us by phone. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you, Lynn. And hello, John. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, well, thanks for joining us. So, quantum theory, I mean, first of all, you have to start with the consideration that many of us are lay people, and we don't even know. I mean, quantum physics, quantum theory is one of those things that's very elusive and very hard to describe. Is it too simple to say that quantum theory explains, you know, what's inexplicable in physics?
I completely sympathize with what you're saying, especially as an educator as well. And I really tried to make this book accessible to as many people as possible. And I would say that, quantum theory does have that reputation, but we're more familiar with it than you might think. It really underwrites our current understanding of how matter is built and how matter interacts. So even if you don't study or think about quantum theory every day, it's at the center of how we even understand how stars shine. It definitely led to being able to understand semiconductors and build computer chips. So it's really pretty ubiquitous, even though it does, in some ways rightly, have a pretty esoteric chalkboard reputation.
Right. So back in around the turn of the century, when Max Planck came up with his theory, it was that they kind of got stuck at this point in physics where they thought they had explained everything, and yet there were things that couldn't be explained. And I suppose it's what you're talking about, how energy and matter are built. What made him sort of strike out on his own with his theory and with this mathematical formula that allowed it to be so and to be true?
Right. Well, I like to think of it as physics, which was a very small field and kind of a backwater scientifically in the 19th century. They did think they had it sewn up. I like to picture it as a rug, and they thought they had sort of a beautiful rug set down, and it was done. And Max Planck famously had a professor when he was studying in Munich as a student. He had a professor say, "You don't want to go into physics because we've finished it." But what really drove Max Planck more than anything was trying to understand why time only marches in one direction, how we have this cascade of events with one falling after the other and never to go backwards. So many things in physics have a left and a right, an up and a down, but time's arrow, which is still enigmatic, by the way, really motivated him. And he went into what was an obscure problem at the time, but it's kind of interesting. So much of physics is motivated by practical technology. So when he moved to Berlin in the 1890s, he was suddenly surrounded by a bunch of people his age who were basically studying light bulbs. Electric light was a new great thing, and people were trying to devise better filaments. And the way an incandescent light bulb
works, not to get down into the weeds, but you, with an electric current, basically you're just heating up a filament, and when it heats up, it follows exactly the same physics that a star would, or a red-hot poker, or a coal in your barbecue, and it starts emitting some light. And Planck actually thought, wow, well, I have all these people studying this problem. I have access to this data that few other people do, and so I'm theoretically going to try to understand this problem. And he actually thought he might be able to find the key to the arrow of time, believe it or not, in this relatively obscure problem.
The arrow of time, and indeed he did. Brandon, you begin the book with one of my favorite science stories. It may be my favorite science story. I originally heard this at Bell Labs in Murray Hill, New Jersey, and then years later, I heard it in an astrophysics class, and I suspect that everybody that takes sort of an entry-level astrophysics class hears this story. But it's a story of Wilson and Penzias on a hill in New York City who borrow this 20-foot-long listening device, radio receiving device. They borrow it from Bell Labs. This thing was used to, you know, listen to Telstar satellites, but Bell Labs made it available to other people. They wanted to go out and listen to the universe, and everywhere they pointed, they heard the same faint microwave signal. And even after filtering out radio signals and trying to get the pigeon dung off this device, but they, you know, it was just incredible. But the gist of it is they discovered cosmic microwave background, the faint afterglow of the Big Bang. And this really confirmed the equations written 60 years earlier by Max Planck, equations that would make Planck's law and forever change all of physics. I mean, it's so interesting when something like that would happen, that someone comes up theoretically with this, and then all of a sudden it's proven 60 years later.
Yes. Yeah, it's fascinating. Especially interesting, so I'm so interested in Planck the human being. And he didn't have a lot of interest in astrophysics, and even recommended to his friend Einstein not to worry about astronomical and gravitational issues. So he was very into the microscopic and earthbound in a way. But his law worked very, very well when he announced it in 1900. There originally wasn't a lot of excitement about it. There weren't a lot of applications for his law. And again, his law describes exactly what colors of light, both visible to the human eye and some kinds of this electromagnetic spectrum that we can't see, but exactly how much of what kind of color of light comes out of a hot object. And it had been confirmed and used. We've been using it before the great microwave background discovery you're mentioning, to diagnose even the exact temperature of stars. So you look at the color of a star, and with Planck's law, we can see exactly what temperature it is. But it was a great shock to find this pattern coming from the very fabric and deep, dark background of space itself. And that, of all the beautiful fits between the real world and Planck's law that he launched in 1900, the best and closest fit is this pristine signal from the afterglow of the Big Bang.
Exactly. Wow. And I'm curious, because Planck was Einstein was a huge fan of Planck's, and wrote these glowing encouragements to the different astronomical societies about Planck as a person and about his work. If it was not for Einstein, would Planck have had the notoriety that he was able to garner over all the years?
Oh, I believe so. I believe so. If anything, I would say Albert Einstein's great glowing comments about Planck helped introduce him more to English audiences, which might not have been as familiar with him. But at least in Europe, I think Planck's legacy was set. And as I detail in the book, it's pretty interesting. His name is so ubiquitous in Germany, where a lot of science grad students and postdocs and whatnot call him Uncle Max. His name adorns all kinds of institutes and the Max Planck Society. which overviews all kinds of academic research now. But that was part of a rebranding. He was a well-known German name that both Germans and Allies could sympathize with after World War II. So it had been called, what's now called the Max Planck Society, was called the Kaiser Wilhelm Society after the monarch of Germany leading up to World War I. And the Allies decided, you know, we need someone less bellicose as a symbol of Germany. We need to kind of rebrand away from the pointy helmet type image. And Max Planck was a name that both sides could kind of agree on. It was against his wishes at first, but during his lifetime, they did start rebranding the old Kaiser Wilhelm Society as the Max Planck Society, in part because he had this great reputation already, and he'd been a spokesperson for science in Germany, but also he had lost a son who was involved in the German resistance, was executed apparently directly on the orders of Adolf Hitler really late in the war, and this brought an extra round of sympathy to him from the Allied side, I'd say.
The tagline of your book, Brandon, Driven by Vision, Broken by War, it's really a two-part story that weaves together really nicely about the historical context in which Planck is, he's aging at this point. I mean, as you say, at the turn of the century, 1900, he proposed his quantum theory, and he was only 42, I believe, at the time. And so when Nazi Germany is heating up and there's a resistance, there's also Planck, who's a Jewish sympathizer and has a lot of Jewish friends and scientists. That's when, you know, he's a lot older at this point, but that's when he encounters a great, a contradiction for himself and his own, you know, sphere of influence. So that part is a very interesting part of your story.
Oh, yeah, thanks very much. I did try to weave the historical and the political and the scientific together to whatever extent I could. But it's interesting. So as a friend of mine said, anyone who stayed in Nazi Germany and retained one or more of their posts has an asterisk by his or her name. And so Planck has a controversial aspect in this way. Now, when Hitler rose as chancellor in 1933, Planck was officially retired from his professorship at the University of Berlin. He had kept several professional society appointments, however, and he was nearing his 75th birthday, and he once said to Einstein in World War I, he said, "I have something that you cannot understand, my friend, and that's an unshatterable bond to the monarch and the country of which I belong." So he was a lifelong patriot, not a Nazi sympathizer at all, but he was put in this incredibly difficult position in 1933, and he hoped, as I believe many Germans did, he called the original rise of the Nazis like, "Oh, this is a thunderstorm which will soon pass." He had a lot of analogies from nature, and he loved long hikes in the mountains, by the way. And he said, "Oh, they'll have to moderate once they've tried governing, etc." But quickly, in half a year, it became much more clear what was happening with a new Nazi government. And Einstein had permanently left Germany and spoken out against the new government. Einstein and Planck's friendship was severed. I mean, they maintained great mutual respect, but their communication ended in 1933 after many decades of great collaboration and communication and even music partnership. That ended. So from Planck saying it's a thunderstorm that will soon pass, by the end of the summer in 1933, he's saying, "Well, this is a landslide, but once the landslide started, you can't stop it." And he said this to some scientists like Otto Hahn, who is a chemist who helped discover the splitting of the atom, actually. Han wanted to organize a protest, and he was telling some of these people, you know, there's no point. We need to do what we can to do good from within, but protesting will do no good at this point. Their power is too strong.
Mm. So interesting that he was a patriot, yet not a Nazi sympathizer. And does he live out the rest of his days in Germany?
Yes. Yeah, he... And including the divided Germany after World War II, he lived in the western part in Göttingen. He did. He kept traveling. At this late stage of his life, he was a public lecturer. He gave a lot of lectures to the general public. One of his most popular, actually, it's very interesting, in the Planck story, was about religion and science. And he saw them as very compatible and necessary in the good and thoughtful life. So this was a very popular lecture. It would bring people to their feet with applause, talking about religion and science. But he kept traveling around Germany and also, controversially, occupied Nazi territories outside of Germany, giving these lectures on until about, into the 40s. And eventually the Gestapo asked him to stop because he didn't have what they considered a proper Christian message in his religion talk. He had sort of a more broad sense of religion, and even spoke late in his life that he didn't necessarily see a personal God or even a Christian God, but just something more broadly spiritual.
We spoke earlier in the in our conversation about the execution of his son Erwin. And for our listeners, it's actually a pretty interesting story. In 1944, Hitler went into a meeting in Poland at the Wolf's Lair, and about 20 of his military people were there. And a guy named Colonel Stauffenberg left the room and left his briefcase that had a bomb in it. It had exploded. It killed, you know, four people, I guess, and injured Hitler. And Hitler went out with the Gestapo, and they hung everybody, the conspirators, but they also found 5,000 other people that had some kind of connection to the conspirators, and that's why they imprisoned him. He used his influence, or his what he thought was influence, to try to free his son, thought that it was actually going to happen after a couple of years or some period of time, but the Gestapo ended up hanging him. I'm curious, why did Erwin, you know, knowing the ruthlessness of the Gestapo and that he was a sympathizer and that he may be associated with this bombing in some way, why did Erwin choose to stay in the country? I mean, if he had fled, he would have been free.
There, that's a great question. There is a period of time where Erwin Planck, who at this time is, after many tragedies in the World War I years, Erwin is Max Planck's last surviving of four children from his first wife at this time. They're very close. And Erwin, from what we can tell, he did help do things like draft a constitution for a post-Nazi Germany, and he was working with people on a possible transition if and when the Nazis fell. That we have no evidence that he actually was involved in the briefcase bomb attack, but he knew everyone involved. So there was a period of time between the attempt on Hitler's life and when Erwin was actually arrested, where he could have gotten out of the country, arguably, but he stayed in Berlin with his wife and was arrested at their home. And I haven't been able to find exactly why he stayed. And I speculate in the book that he might have thought he was too far removed from the conspirators, and his father relied on him a lot at the time. And maybe he didn't want to leave his father in Germany, or maybe he thought he wouldn't have any chance of getting across the border anyway. But we don't know, and he was then imprisoned and interrogated and tortured for months by the Gestapo. And this is part of the frame of the book, I think, since readers are maybe less familiar with 19th century German history, which I try to illuminate some, and maybe more familiar with the history of World War II. I set the book very late in Max Planck's life, and with Erwin in the hands of the Gestapo and Max Planck, writing these letters and doing what he can do, trying to pull whatever he can in the Nazi bureaucracy to free his son.
Okay. Max Planck's law is significant. Can you tell us of something else that Max came up with that has tremendous application today?
Oh, sure. He was, when I say driven by vision, this what really drove him more than anything was the idea of entropy. Now, this is, if quantum physics is esoteric, entropy can be very confusing and misunderstood. It's confused to a lot of our physics students as well. But it was, in one sense, a new way in the 19th century, and it was brand new when Max Planck was a student, so he's very excited about this new topic. It was sort of a way to annotate the arrow of time. And he, in his PhD thesis, he really illuminated that he stated in the first time from an equation that entropy over time would achieve at least the same value, numeric entropy, or grow over time. That systems would become, in some ways, more complicated over time and less ordered, if you will. And so he, more than anyone, I would say, in his career, he kept coming back and using entropy and talking about entropy and working with it in thermodynamics. And so he really helped push entropy forward as a useful tool. And today we even use it in information theory. Entropy is key to people who theoretically study black holes of all things, even in the thermodynamics of designing a good car engine. These are quantities you have to keep track of. And he's someone who really made it more of a real tool instead of an abstract concept.
Mm. So, you know, recently we've spoken to some physicists who are, or rather journalists who are talking about are writing about some physicists that are furthering Einstein's theories. And I'm just wondering how much Planck's work has been, you know, how much quantum theory has been sort of improved upon since the turn of the century, since 1900?
Oh, that's a wonderful question, Lynn. It's been improved upon greatly. I can't emphasize enough that Max Planck has been called a reluctant revolutionary. And I think one reason I became fascinated by him when I myself was a student is he stumbled upon this perfect equation, and he spent many years of his life trying to explain why this was the equation that nature had. And his friend Einstein greatly moved forward quantum theory. In fact, Einstein first used the word quantum with respect to these effects that Max Planck had found. And there's a steady march of improvements, starting with Niels Bohr and this whole idea of the planetary quantized atom in the 19-teens, and then Heisenberg and Schrodinger and this gang with real quantum mechanics in the 1920s, to where you can actually predict the crowning glory of quantum mechanics was probably being able to describe the spectrum when you burn different elements. You know, why is sodium burning red and things like that? Well, quantum theory could really describe the structure of atoms well enough where we could perfectly fingerprint these signatures of atoms, the atomic spectra. So it advanced so far from 1900. In fact, the study of quantum theory didn't get going till 1913. It really picked up. So there were 13 years after Max Planck's discovery when most people didn't know what to make of it. Like, okay, it fits data for light bulbs really well, but he can't explain why it works, and we don't know what to do with it yet.
Brandon, I wanted to mention, because this was fascinating, just a quick mention, and then we're going to have to scoot because we're running out of time. Mm-hmm. But it's just a comment. When I was reading your book, you know, we always think that these people come up with these extraordinary equations and they're good to go, but in Planck's case and in other cases as well, equations are put together and they don't really have the constant worked out, or they have a fudge factor in there. Then they go back and they try to test it and to plug in different values and things like that. So it's not like they have these thoughts of exactly what the equation is. It sort of evolves over time, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the great joys of doing the research on this book is really teasing out all the depths of a great discovery. And I think more often than not in science, it's really incremental. And of course, in a textbook and of course in teaching it, we have to say, well, this is what happened in this year, and this person had a genius moment. But it's always built on a long series of really and refined. And I think I say in the book at some point that scientists are more rearranging and flipping puzzle pieces. And the aha moments are just like, oh, now I had all these pieces and I see how they fit together rather than building whole new pieces from scratch, which is kind of how we tell the history, right? That this brilliant, the apple hit Newton in the head and suddenly gravity, when it's so much richer than that if you have time to delve into it.
Yeah. Brandon Brown, thank you so much for joining us today and also for writing this book. I really enjoy this genre of great biographies that take these scientists who are esoteric, enigmatic characters and bring them down to, you know, the person who's maybe not a scientist. So thank you for writing this.
Well, I want to thank you both. I was just delighted to be here.
And thanks for cleaning up my German pronunciation. I've always seen his name, and I guess I've never heard it before. I call it, I say Planck, you say Planck, so that's...
I know you're out of time, but it's kind of a cheat, right? Max, I'm giving a very English pronunciation,
yeah.
And Planck is the typical German pronunciation of the last name. But, yeah.
So it's really Max Planck.
Yes.
Okay. Brandon, thanks for your time today. Take care.
Thanks again.
And that was Brandon Brown. He's the author of the biography of Max Planck, Driven by Vision, Broken by War. An interesting conversation. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake. Info at hideoutcanyon.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law. LRW-law.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Thank our underwriters today, Peak Art and Frame and Nexus IT.